Today's Tesha will be on case 74 in the Book of Serenity. Case 74 is Phaon's substance and name. Introduction: plenty has myriad virtues. Swept clear, there's not a mote of dust. Detached from all forms, identical to all things, taking a step atop a 100-foot pole. The universe in all directions is one's body. But tell me, where does it come from? Case. A monk asked Phaon, I hear that in the teachings there is a saying, from a non-abiding basis are all things established. What is the non-abiding basis? Phaon said, form arises before substantiation, names arise from before naming. Verse, without tracks, no news. The white clouds are rootless. What color is the pure breeze? Spreading the canopy of the sky, mindless, holding the carriage of the earth, powerful. Illuminating the source of 1,000 ages, making patterns for 10,000 forms. Meetings for enlightenment in the atoms of all lands in each place is Samantabhadra. The door of the tower opens. Everywhere is Maitreya. So I want to thank everyone for coming this morning and sitting so well and doing such a great job. It's so wonderful to practice with people who are sitting wholeheartedly. And for many, you know, in many cases, people have been here from 7 o'clock in the morning. This kind of prolonged sitting, long sitting, is so important. And 2 or 3 hours of sitting makes a big difference in your life. This sounds like a really dry koan. A monk asked Master Phaon, I hear that in the teachings there is a saying, from a non-abiding basis are established all things. What is the non-abiding basis? Phaon said, form arises before substantiation, names arise before naming. So that just seems, you know, that just seems like what's that all about, right? What's form, what's substantiation? And, you know, if you were given this koan by the teacher, you know, you might go to your computer and look up the Encyclopedia of Buddhism, and you might check out what form is and what substantiation is, or you could go to, I think it's a Buddhist wiki, so you could go there. The commentary is not helpful at all, so let me read it. Manjushri asked Vimalakirti, what is the basis of the body? Vimalakirti said, craving is the basis of the body. Manjushri asked, what is the basis of craving? Vimalakirti says, false discrimination is the basis of craving. Manjushri asked, what is the basis of false discrimination? Vimalakirti said, erroneous conception is the basis of false discrimination. Manjushri asked, what is the basis of erroneous conception? Vimalakirti said, non-abiding is the basis. Manjushri asked, what is the basis of non-abiding? Vimalakirti said, non-abiding has no basis. Manjushri, all things are established from a non-abiding basis. Okay, so then it goes on and quotes some other Zen masters who have to put in their 2 cents. Okay. So actually that was, believe it or not, that could be helpful. You know, in Mahayana thinking, at some point, people ask the question, okay, you know, we're trying to achieve enlightenment. But why are we trying to achieve enlightenment? How did this ever happen to us that we need to achieve enlightenment? See? So, you know, especially in early Buddhism, you know, there's an attention to the strategies that will lead to awakening. But, you know, as Buddhism goes on, people are saying, well, how did we get so screwed up to begin with? And of course, you know, we could all spend a long time thinking about how we all got so screwed up. There are accidents of our personal biography, right? There are, you know, psychological obstacles that, you know, one might deal with on the cushion or deal with a therapist. You know, there's all of that. And you know, when the Mahayana teachers asked, why are we so screwed up? Why do we need to be, why do we need to practice in order to become awakened? Why aren't we awakened? They understood those factors were significant. And we spend a lot of time in our Zen practice working through those factors, those obstacles. But this goes even deeper, right? I mean, you know, one of the things that, you know, I think of Buddhism this way. You know, I don't think of Buddha, you know, I don't think of Buddhism as a divine revelation that was delivered in its perfect form, and that was it, right? I mean, in some religions, that's definitely the case, right? So the Quran was dictated to Muhammad by Allah, and it's the words of Allah, and it can't be tampered with, right? Even though actually historically the Quran has been tampered with many times, right? So in fact, the book, the Quran, is not pristine. It's been edited, it's been, the surah, the chapters have been rearranged and so on. You know, there are many Americans who believe that the Bible is the word of God. It's not, you know, it doesn't even claim to be. But many people feel like this is the teaching, here it is. It's all between these pages, and that's it. And we know that's not true either. Books of the books of the Torah were left out. Books of the Bible, you know, the Christian Bible were left out. There's all these gospels that were excluded from the Bible. There's all these apocryphal books in Jewish tradition and in Christian tradition. So we know there isn't such a thing as a pristine utterance, right? But I think Buddhism knows this and is very straightforward about this. At least the Mahayana is, you know. The sutras that we have been studying in our sutra study group are the early, the Pali sutras, or the in Sanskrit they're called the Agamas. But actually, you know, the something like the Prajnaparamita literature that we're going to look at next, that was like 600 years later, really, you know. And people wrote things, and they wrote in the Buddha's voice. The Buddha is speaking, and they wrote it down. They said, this is what the Buddha said, or would have said. We're going to read the Diamond Sutra, which is 1st or 2nd century Common Era. It claims to be the voice of the Buddha, speech of the Buddha. In other words, you know, these Mahayana people said, look, it's okay for us to put words in the Buddha's mouth, because what we're doing every day is following his path, and we're investigating reality. We're not just receiving a message from a divine revelation. What the Buddha said to do was practice. And he said, investigate reality. So you know, Buddhism has this long history of innovation, because, you know, lots of nuns and monks were meditating and exploring consciousness more and more fully. So you know, Buddhism is like Buddhism is basically a movement, you could say, that is dedicated to the liberation of all sentient beings from illusion. And your people who are committed to that project have to wake up themselves. They have to free themselves from their obstacles and wake up. And then they have to help others wake up. But all of this involves discovery, asking questions. You know, koans are questions, really, right? You know, so Buddhism is an ongoing project. It's like a research project. Buddhism has like an ongoing research component, and it has an ongoing liberation component. It has a social component. All of this is one big project, right? So the Mahayana teachers didn't just receive information from the past. They met it, you know, Zen belongs to a tradition of Buddhism called the Yogacara school. The Yogacarans I completely adore and love. And that is the school that discovered the unconscious mind. The early Buddhists didn't have a concept of the unconscious mind, and Theravada people don't have a robust idea about the unconscious mind. So mindfulness is totally oblivious to the unconscious mind. They discovered, these meditators, the Yogacarans, it means the people who do a lot of yoga. What we're doing here is yoga. So the people who are our Dharma ancestors in the Zen lineage and in some of the Tibetan lineages were, you know, they got up in the morning and they meditated, and they went to Sesshin and they meditated for 9 hours, and they noticed things about ordinary consciousness, and they noticed things about enlightened consciousness, see? So they were exploring all the time. You know, the history of Buddhism is a history of exploration, discovery, questioning, and innovation, really. So basically, these early Buddhists didn't ask, how did we get so screwed up? But later Buddhists did. They said, how did we get so screwed up? And there is this issue of our personal screw-up-edness, right? You know, our personal biography. But they said, actually, like, in the first instances of our consciousness, we began to go off the rails. Yeah, that's what they said. You know, it's like, you're born and you start forming a consciousness. You start constructing your mind. And, you know, from the long before you understood what you were doing, you made some mistakes. You know, it's like you made some mistakes and you assembled your consciousness in the wrong way. And this is like characteristic of human beings. We make these mistakes. They're easy mistakes to make, right? And so, you know, this is a theory not of enlightenment, but a theory of endarkenment. See, I think this is so important. You know, we're all striving for enlightenment because we somehow became endarkened, right? How did we get so endarkened? And the great, great teachers of the Yogacara said it happened very quickly. You know, you're born, and then you make some mistakes, and then you build on those patterns, those errors, and over time it creates the life that's so screwed up and that needs to meditate in order to wake up. See, I hope I'm making some sense. So this little dialogue between Manjushri is and Vimalakirti is actually taking us through the backwards through the steps of endarkenment. So Manjushri asks Vimalakirti, what is the basis of the body? And Vimalakirti said, craving is the basis of the body. So basically, you know, actually enlightened beings don't have a body. You can say, well, they have to eat, the Buddha ate, yes, but they don't experience their physical form the way we do, we unenlightened people do, right? They don't experience their physical form that way. They experience the body differently. And by the way, we experience the body differently when we're in deep samadhi. You know, normally the boundary between the body and everything else is very clear cut. So we say, this is my body, right? This is my body, and good. You know, in many reasons you have to draw boundaries, right? You know, but actually our experience of our body is very confining and actually wrong from a Buddhist standpoint. You know, we think about our bodies as separate from everything else. You know, when you walk into a room, you might think, you know, oh, how do I look? You know, I look terrible today. You know, my hair, I mean, when I used to have hair, right? My hair doesn't look good, you know. I need to lose a little weight. You know, I'm getting a paunch, you know, all of this stuff, right? This is a samsaric experience of the body, right? Just thinking of experiencing the body as so separate is a samsaric experience of the body that has taken a long time to, you know, people have very unhealthy relationships to their bodies. They're never good enough, strong enough, you know, thin enough, tall enough. You know, your face is too round, your face is too long, you know, your nose is too big, your nose is too snubbed. You know, this is like samsara, right? But when we're on the cushion, you know, all of that goes away. This is why Buddhism, I think this is the coolest thing in the world. There's nothing like this in the world. You can go to therapy, I mean, I'm not criticizing therapy, but you can go to therapy for 20 years and it won't, you know, it won't liberate you like this. You sit down on the cushion and your relationship to your body completely changes. All of those questions, those anxieties, you know, am I too thin? Am I too fat? All of that just goes away. And now the body is very different. You know, when you're in samadhi, you experience your body so differently. First of all, the boundaries between your body and the world around you are not clear anymore. It's very difficult to say where you start and where you stop and where the world starts. So there's like a diffused body. It doesn't have a clear form. You're not self-referencing, so you're not forming a self-image. You know, it's porous, and you hear and you feel, but it's not localized. You know, this is so amazing, right? This is not an illusion. You know, you can say, well, that's just an illusion. No, it's the Buddhist view is, no, that's a correct experience of the body. Normal experiences of the body are incorrect. They're caught up in suffering, right? Suffering. You know, so look, when we're in samadhi, we experience the body totally differently, and it's revolutionary. It's like, who cares? You know, what knows? When I'm in samadhi, I don't even have a nose, right? I hear, but I don't have ears. I breathe, but I don't have a nose, right? My body is diffused over like a field. It's like a vortex, and I'm of sensations, right? And this is totally different. And from the Buddhist standpoint, this is more correct, right? More enlightened, right? The endarkened view is that I'm too fat or too thin, you know, I need to get a toupee, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I need a nose job, you know. Those are all unhealthy relationships to the self, to the body. So Vimalakirti said, how do we ever form that horrible false view of our bodies? And Vimalakirti says, craving. Craving. He says, well, what's the basis? Craving means wherever I am, it's not good enough. Whatever it is, it's not good enough. See? I think we all, when we go into teenager period, right, we're in that, we learn how to crave, right? And craving overtakes us. It's never good enough, right? You have to own a certain kind of shirt, You drag your parents over to the store, you make them buy this very expensive shirt, you put it on, but you know, you don't look like, you know, the model, you know, you and now you know it's still not right, you know, and so basically, what is the basis of the body? Craving. What is, you know, craving? Craving means whatever I have is not what I want. I want something else. And he says, what's the basis of craving? False discrimination. To set up what you like against what you dislike, right? You know, just having a shirt is good, you know? Just having a shirt. For many people, just having a shirt is an accomplishment. It's a good day when you get a shirt, right? It doesn't have to look like, you know, Lady Gaga's shirt, right? Or, you know, Brad Pitt's shirt, right? So false, and then he says, where does false discrimination come? Erroneous conception, and so on. And it's like following the errors down. It's like the moment you were born, you made the mistake of thinking you were separate from everything else. You know, and you can be forgiven for making that mistake. We all do it, but it's a mistake. It's like when humans develop their consciousness, when they're creating their consciousnesses, they make this mistake of imagining themselves as separate from everything else. And it happens in a split second, but that starts us down a road to, you know, the world we live in now. So that's the story of our endarkenment. See. And, you know, what we're doing in our meditation practice is gradually correcting those mistakes, right? So you go into samadhi and you experience your body in a totally different way. It's so wonderful. It's blissful, right? It's blissful not to be imprisoning yourself in these mental images of how you're supposed to look. You have this porous body now, which is, you know, basically everything around you. It's hard to say where you start and where you stop. The world becomes your body, as it says, right? Really. You know, after a session, you're driving home and you look at the trees and there's no boundary between yourself and the trees. There's no boundary between yourself and the grass. This is actually true. This is actually real. The boundary is the fantasy, right? So what we're doing in meditation practice is there's endarkenment. We're enlightening ourselves by working through one layer of error after another, see. So this koan is really, really maybe one of the most important koans. The koan is actually asking us to sort of realize this in our practice, right? You know, if you suddenly, you know, if you are sitting on the cushion and you're in samadhi and you just pay attention, you think of your body, you suddenly realize I'm experiencing my body so differently. Right? Or, you know, I myself, am a snacker. You know, I hope you won't hold it against me. But you know, when I write, I don't smoke cigarettes, right? So, which is a really good thing. But what I do when I write for like a couple of hours, I'll come down and I'll have a snack, right? And one of the snacks I like is I like corn chips a lot, right? You know, so I'll come down and I'll have some corn chips or something. You know, and if I'm not careful, I can actually go through like a bag of corn chips in a couple of days. Right? So, you know, I try to ration my corn chips. I try to, you know, but, well, you know, every time I go down and I get some corn chips, the next bowl of corn chips is already, you know, in my mind. And, you know, if I'm stressed when I'm writing, you know, then if I go down and I have some, you know, especially carbohydrates, right? You know, they're very, it feels very good. You know, carbs, very, you feel calm. They make you feel calm and happy, right? So, you know, I'm creating a, it's, you know, it's not a federal fence. It's just corn chips, you know, and they can't really hurt you. You know, they're not really bad, that bad for you. But you know, craving, you know, we do this in many, many ways. But, you know, when you're really on the cushion and you're in deep samadhi, you know, craving, you know, you may come out of the depths of your meditation and think, boy, corn chips, they are good, you know. But when you're in your deep samadhi, you know, that craving has completely disappeared. Because just being here now is everything. There's no future corn chips coming. There's just now, right? So you know, basically, we experience an existence that does not have craving when we meditate, when we're in deep samadhi, and when we're in deep mushin also, right? So a lot of Zen practice is on-endarkening ourselves, right? We endarkened ourselves over the course of our life, starting with that one fatal decision where we thought we were separate from mom, right? Or we thought we were separate from our brother and sister. And that sort of is like you're on that road and you get to Donald Trump, basically, you know, when everything goes wrong. A man who is truly, truly trapped. He is a textbook case of somebody who's trapped in illusion, right? Just to the point of being unable to sustain human relationships. He's completely narcissistic. He's totally a prisoner of these forces, right? So anyway, the koan, you know, one dimension of this koan is you begin to realize that you don't always have a body, that you aren't always craving, that you aren't always separating yourself, right? You know, sometimes you can't define the boundary between yourself and the world. You are what you're seeing. You are what you're hearing, right? This is like, from the Buddhist standpoint, this is a reality that we have stepped out of or made a mistake, right? So you know, in one sense, right, this koan is really, it can be really liberating and wonderful if you just start noticing what it's like to be in samadhi or what it's like to be in mushin or to come out of mushin and be in a unified mind in accord with the way. But on the other hand, you know, for many people, this could seem really intimidating, right? This project could seem really intimidating. It's like, okay, now wait a minute, I'm really screwed up, right? I mean, I have a false view of my body, I crave all the time, I have false discrimination, I have, you know, erroneous conception, you know. That's a lot of work. It's like, man, there's a lot of layers and levels there to work through. Very intimidating in a certain sense, right? You know, we've been reading the Pali text, the Pali suttas. They're called suttas in Pali, sutras in Sanskrit. And, you know, a big feature of the Pali sutras is the jhanas, the levels or layers of consciousness. In many, many of the sutras, the Buddha rehearses the jhanas. Those are like states of concentration, you could say. So he says, you know, how did I wake up? How did I escape from my endarkenment? He doesn't use that word, but he could. He said, well, what I did was I went somewhere that was pleasant and secluded. And I, you know, just, you know, if you're in a very hectic situation and you just get out of it and go into a room that's quiet and peaceful, already you feel better, right? You know, I can remember long ago, like 50 years ago, being in Mexico. And, you know, in a lot of towns in Mexico, they have a plaza they call a Zocalo. And the Zocalo is like bustling, booming, people are selling things, there's restaurants all around this central square, maybe with a fountain in it. And it's just like a din of noise sometime, right? And then you duck into one of these churches, right? And they're built out of big, thick stone, and it's absolutely quiet. It's like you can hear yourself think, as we say, right? That's the first jhana, right? Just jhana, that's a jhana. And then, you know, you stop thinking, right? The loops in your head stop, and that's the second jhana. You know, and then, you know, basically, you begin to just be attentive to what's happening around you, right? And that's the third jhana. And then, you know, your mind begins to be empty. Right, and that's, like you could say, that's moving into the fourth jhana. Now you're ready to, or your mind is focused on one thing at a time, right? That's the fourth jhana, and then you're moving into the formless jhanas, and that's emptiness, infinite space, no time, and awareness neither of being aware nor not being aware, right? So, you know, the early Buddhists, and even today, many people in certain Buddhist traditions, you know, they work their way through the jhanas. And, you know, you could say to yourself, oh my God, you know, I'm going to spend years on this project, right? You know, I have to go through all eight of the jhanas to wake up. And, you know, it's very hard to do that, right? And anyway, this happens in Buddhism, where, you know, when people think, oh my God, you know, my first mental formation was that I was separate from everything around me. And I've been making it worse and worse every moment of my life, right? You know, holy smokes, you know. Then it just seems like awakening seems like this incredibly formidable and difficult thing. And, it took you, however old you are, it took you 35 years or 40 years or 50 years to get where you are. You might think, I need to take another 50 years to darken myself, right? Luckily, no, right? Luckily, no, but why not, right? Why not? Same thing with the jhanas. You know, you could say, oh my God, it's going to take me years to master the jhanas. And indeed, it kind of does. It takes a long time. You know, so when people start meditating, it's a struggle. I used to go to the University of Washington Wednesday nights to sit with Genki Roshi and Webb. And after 20 minutes, I was covered with sweat. It was so hard to do this. I wasn't sitting full lotus. I was just sitting with my legs crossed in front of me. It was just like, when is that bell going to ring? And it took me a while before I began to enter into like a light samadhi. And, you know, it took me a few years of practice before I could get deeply into samadhi. And then it took me a number of years of practice before I could enter mu. You know, it took me a long time. And, you know, it has not been... From one standpoint, it's taken a lot of sitting, a lot of work, and it does. It requires a lot of effort, a lot of work. It definitely does. If you don't put in the hours on the cushion, it's not going to happen. It's just true for everything. It's like you're not going to be an artist if you don't paint. You're not going to play the guitar if you don't practice every day. You're not going to wake up if you don't practice every day. But on the other hand, you know, you can actually like psych yourself out. You know, I think a lot of Buddhists psych themselves out, especially like people who are Buddhist by cultural tradition, right? You know, in Sri Lanka, at one time, recently, the monastic community in Sri Lanka actually decided that enlightenment was no longer possible for human beings. They actually decided this was like a movement in Sri Lanka in the 18th century. A lot of teachers were just not waking up. A lot of monks and nuns weren't waking up themselves. They weren't having a daikensho. And they just decided this is impossible. Nobody can do this because our reality has become so debased. Our consciousnesses have become so debased that it's all we can hope for is to just be decent people and sort of enter samadhi. You know, meanwhile, in China and Japan and in Burma, people were having daikensho all the time. So the Sri Lankan monks were mistaken, right? But they psyched themselves out. They thought, oh my God, this is such a mountain, nobody can climb it. So this koan is, a lot's going on in this koan, but I think this koan is really about this psyching yourself out aspect of practice, where you think, oh my God, I've been on the wrong road since I was a baby. You know, how am I ever going to overcome this? And, you know, this koan lays out all of these different mistakes that we make on the way to our endarkenment. And the Pali Sutras lay out all of this sort of scaffolding, right? You know, each of the jhanas has these characteristics, and you know, it might take you a few years to get through the first four jhanas, and can you sustain the first four jhanas? There are other cases of this too. Like, you know, if I may say so, there's different kinds of Tibetan Buddhism, right? So there's the Gelugpa Buddhism, which is the Dalai Lama's Buddhism. There's Dzogchen, there's Nyingma, there's all these different schools. And some of them, like Mahamudra's, very close to Zen, like identical really, except somewhat different in its methods. But the Gelugpa school is like the most scholarly, right? So my teacher Glenn Webb, my beloved teacher who recently died, you know, he trained in Japan for a while, for many years, and then he came back to the United States, but he continued to go back to Japan to keep his Japanese up, right? He needed, you know, you can lose it very quickly if you don't use it. And also, he used to take a tour group through China, and they would go he had connections with some of the temples there, and then they would go up into Tibet, and he would lead this tour through Tibet, and they'd end in Lhasa, right? And Webb did this for many years. He actually used to work as a courier for the Dalai Lama. So Webb would, before he did his tour, he would go to Darjeeling, and he would like get all these messages that he was supposed to give from the Dalai Lama to these monastic communities in Tibet. And he would go on the tour, and he would meet the teachers, and he would deliver personal messages. He really did this from the Dalai Lama. He eventually was caught. And he wasn't shot. He just wasn't able to go back into Tibet ever again. He also got involved in kind of a scuffle because he saw a Red Guard. He saw an army soldier of the, you know, People's Liberation Army beating up a Tibetan guy. So he eventually was banned from Tibet. But, you know, he had a lot of friends in the Gelugpa tradition. And some of them even used to come to the Seattle Zen Center. The Dalai Lama's tutor used to come and meditate with us. Yes, yeah. The Dalai Lama came and visited our Zen Center before he was a rock star, by the way. So anyway, the Gelug people, believe that you really shouldn't be doing what we do in Zen until you have a thorough knowledge of all the scriptures, right? So they don't do emptiness meditation, my teacher Webb has told me, until many years later in their practice. It's like first 20 years is study, and then the next 20 years is the practice, right? So you get the theory and then you do the practice. And so, you know, when Webb was talking to some of these Tibetan Gelugpa people, they said, you do what? Emptiness meditation. And he said, you know, it's like you go into samadhi, and once you can go into samadhi, the teacher gives you emptiness meditation. And the Gelugpa people were astounded. They thought, oh my God, that's so dangerous, you know, that's so, you know, you need preparation, you need study, you know. And anyway, you know, it's another example, I think, of you know, basically the stages and the steps become so involved, they become so extended, that it's like it might take you 60 years to finish, to become a geshe, you know, get the PhD in Gelug Buddhism. You need to spend like 20 years or something. It's quite a more. Right, and you know, so it's this big enterprise. You start creating all these steps and stages that you have to go through to get to enlightenment, and then they get to be so numerous, you think, how will I ever get there? See, but the thing that's so important, this is the most important thing in the whole of Buddhism. I think this is the most important thing. This koan, which looks so boring, is really important, because enlightenment is not a state of mind. See, samadhi is a state of mind, craving, state of mind, but enlightenment is not a state of mind. It's outside all states of mind. See, it's outside of all it's not a state of mind. If somebody says enlightened state of mind, they're speaking, I say that myself, but it's actually, enlightenment is not a state of mind. States of mind are all exist within the realm of form. And the realm, enlightenment is outside the realm of form and formlessness, actually. It's totally not caught in any of these boxes. So what this means is that, you know, actually, you can experience enlightened mind. You can experience enlightened mind, whether you are at the first jhana or the eighth jhana. You know, some people have experiences of kensho experiences early in their Zen practice. You know, they come to a sesshin. They watch their breath, and they have like this experience, like boom. It didn't happen to me, but it happens to people. You know, and you think, well, that's not fair. How did that happen? He hasn't gone through all the steps and stages. It's because, you know, the steps and stages, it's like, if you think about this, you know, there's the world of form. It's this circle, right? It's like, and it's got these steps and stages. But, you know, what you could call the luminous field of awakening is not in any of those. Those are in the luminous field of awakening, if that makes any sense. So look, we are always in enlightenment. Always in enlightenment. We just have created obstacles. So somebody who is in the first jhana can actually stumble into enlightenment. Yes. People who are in the second jhana can actually stumble into enlightenment. Yes, it happens. You know, years ago, there was a very famous Japanese monk named Yasutani Roshi. And one day he was leading a public sit, and he was doing Dokusan with people. It's like these people just came to this, you know, afternoon of meditation or day of meditation, and And he was doing Dokusan, and this woman came in, this American woman. Her name was Flora Courtois. Yeah, that was her name. I used to have her picture. And she said, you know, when I was a teenager, this happened to me. And then she did, and she described Daikensho. And he said, oh, you've had Daikensho, my dear, right? And you could say, well, how the hell did that happen, right? Don't you have to go through all the jhanas? Don't you have to go through all the steps and stages of on and darkening yourself? And I would say, yes, generally that's true. But the point is, enlightened mind is possible every moment of your life, every step of your practice. You know, it happens, right? And that's because enlightenment is not a state of mind. It's we have to work through many different states of mind, but at some point we step out of the whole system of states of mind, and we realize our fundamental nature, you know. That's the truth, you know. I mean, enlightenment is not another state of mind. It's outside of all states of mind. And that's really what this koan is getting at, right? It's like, you know, people can come to their first sesshin and have a breakthrough. In fact, that happened to Joshu, right? Joshu came, was just a kid, and he went to a sesshin with Nanchuan. Joshu, Jiaozhou, went to a sesshin with Nanchuan, and he had a Kensho experience that was so moving. It was like he was a totally, after it was over, he couldn't go home. He said, like, everything I thought was important, I don't think is important anymore. You know, we have a misunderstanding about enlightenment. We think it's a state of mind. So, you know, if Joshua had been an American, he probably would have said, okay, I've had Daikensho, all good, now I can go on with my career and write a book about it and go on the talk show circuit. But Joshua said, you know, how do I live in this place? And he became Nanchuan's nonsense student for 40 years till Nanchuan died. So it's always here. We have developed all of these skillful means, these scaffolds, to help us get there, and we need them. We just do. But, you know, people who have never heard of the jhanas have had Daikensho, and people who have never heard of Daikensho have had Daikensho. And that's because, you know, it's awakening is not a state of mind. It's the liberation from all states of mind, right? They're all, you know, they're all real in a certain sense, and they're all imaginary in a certain sense, right? And all of them are contained, all of them are within awakened mind. And that's why, you know, even when we have a bad sit, you know, so-called, you know, when our minds are in turmoil or we can't answer our koan, you know, it could be so bitter, you know, so bitter. You go to a whole sesshin and maybe you spend 7 days working on a koan, and in your mind you're going to go into the Dokusan room on the last day and you're going to go blah, 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 and the teacher's going to go, ah, you've got it, you know. And then the teacher says, oh, I'm sorry, you know, you really don't have it. You're really not there. And, you know, you can get hopping mad, but then all of a sudden you realize, oh, it's so good to be alive, you know, and also I love this, you know, I just love this. I couldn't answer the Mu Koan for like 4 years. I went through all the stages of like death, right, you know, denial, you know, finally like acceptance, and then you sort of surrender, and it's like, when you surrender, it's like, oh my God, what a wonderful path this is. You know, I haven't passed a single koan. How wonderful. It's just like you push yourself into that awakened mind again. So don't psych yourself out is the point, the message of the koan. Introduction. Plenty has myriad virtues. Abundance has myriad virtues. Swept clear, there's not a mote of dust. Detached from all forms, enlightened mind is detached from all forms, identical to all things. Taking a step atop the 100-foot pole, the universe in all directions becomes one's whole body. But tell me, where does it come from? A monk asked Fayan, I hear that in the teachings there is a saying, from a non-abiding basis are established all things. What is the non-abiding basis? Fayan said, form arises before substantiation, names arise before naming. But the non-abiding basis has no name and no form. And every once in a while, we realize that on and off the cushion. Verse, without tracks, no news. See, without tracks, enlightenment is without tracks. We create tracks, we create maps, we create scaffolds, we create systems. But enlightenment is like a bird, is like the flight of a bird, it's trackless. Reality is like the flight of the bird, it's trackless. Without news, without tracks, no news. The white clouds are rootless. What color is the pure breeze? Spreading the canopy of sky, mindless, holding the carriage of the earth, powerful, illumining the profound source of 1,000 ages, making patterns for 10,000 forms, meetings for enlightenment in the atoms of all lands, in each place is Samantapadra. It's like each place awakening is possible. The door of the tower opens. Everywhere is Maitreya. Everywhere is the Buddha of the future.